This is the seventh and last day of this June 1975 session. Before we close the Teisho, we'll have something to say about the session, but we'll now go on with the next koan in the Mumon Khan, number 36. And this is called Goso's No Words or Silence. Another translation of that is Meeting a Man of the Way on the Way. And it reads, Goso said, if you meet a man of the way on the way, greet him neither with words nor with silence. Now tell me, how will you greet him? And then Mumon's commentary. If you can give an apt answer to the question, it is certainly a matter for congratulation. If you are not yet able to give one, be alert in every aspect of your life. And then Mumon's verse. If you meet a man of the way on the way, greet him neither with words nor with silence. Give him an uppercut. And as for understanding, he'll understand it once. We'll have something, a lot more to say about that when we get to the verse. Now we've already talked about Goso. There isn't very much on him, but we did find here another one of his teisho in his old age. And it goes this way. He says, yesterday I found a certain passage, and I wondered if I should bring it up before all of you. But as I am an old man, I have forgotten the whole thing entirely. For some time I thought about it, but it wouldn't come back to me. And then he remained silent, and then he said, I have forgotten, I have forgotten. And then he added, there is a Mahayana Dharani named the Wise Enlightening King. If you recite it, you remember what you have forgotten. And then he began reciting, Anaro Roku Ke Shabaka. And then he clapped his hands. Ha, 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 I remember, I remember. And then he went, if you try to find a Buddha, you can never see him. If you search for a patriarch, you will never meet him. The sweet melon is sweet to the root. The bitter melon is bitter to the root. Why, if you try to find a Buddha, can't you see him? And if you search for a patriarch, you will never meet him. You can also say, if you try to be a good man, you'll never be one. You remember this very, fine mundo between Nanchuan, Nansen, and the governor, Governor Rico of the province, where after one kind of session, before the governor was going back to his administrative offices, Nanchuan said to him, when you get back to your office, how will you rule the people? How will you govern the people? And the governor said, with compassion and understanding. Then there came the surprising answer. In that case, every last one of them will suffer. You can't try to be a good man. You can't try to be even a loving man. The very effort condemns the result. Being a good man, being a loving person, is the outcome of a certain mind quality, a certain harmony, a certain poise, a certain equilibrium, equanimity, a certain purity. In other words, when we have removed all of the hindrances to the natural outflow of these qualities, which are our birthright, then we become what the world would call good. We become loving, we become compassionate, and so on. This is what is the trouble in our culture. Always throwing around the word love. Always people are being told in the certain religions that teach this. Tell you to be loving. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Perhaps on a purely ethical basis, it might have some value. But it is an extremely superficial way to understand what is involved. The same way, if you try to find a Buddha, you can never see him. If you search for a patriarch, you will never meet him. Now the second part, the sweet melon is sweet to the root, the bitter melon is bitter to the root. What's the connection between that and the second part? When we taste a melon, a sweet melon, taste it as thoroughly sweet. You taste a bitter melon, taste it as thoroughly bitter. Make a terrible face when you eat a bitter melon, especially if you were expecting a sweet melon. To be a Buddha is nothing more or less than that. Now let us come to the case. That's all we have added for Goso. If you meet a man of the way on the way, greet him neither with words nor with silence. Of course, words here refers to conceptual thinking. Self-conscious verbalizing. We must also remember that silence is also a form of speaking. Just as the white part of a design is as much a part of it as the black part or the printed part, in the same way, ordinary silence, which stands against speaking, is a form of thought, is a form of speaking, really. We talked in an earlier teisho about the various kinds of silences. But true silence, if there's no thought in your mind at all, not even about silence, and you're absolutely one, indivisible, with a certain individual, then one here means that, of course, one could not be one, one could have no thoughts hanging in the mind and still be separated, it's true. Although that's a very hard thing to do, really. If you're with somebody and there's absolutely nothing in your mind, it's almost impossible not to be one with a person. person who habitually lives this way, he has no need to try to practice good deeds or to avoid evil. He has no attachments to his mind, no attachment to the products of his mind or to his body. His eyes see things, but he doesn't become attached to them. He hears things, doesn't become attached to them. His hearing is a kind of a no-hearing. His seeing is a kind of no-seeing. Or you could say, he hears with his eyes and he sees with his ears. How is it possible to greet somebody with neither words nor with silence? This, of course, is what the koan poses. And in working on this koan in the Doksan room, one has to express one's freely working Zen. Only when you get yourself into this state can you really properly respond to this koan. Now notice it says, if you meet a man of the way on the way. We've talked about way. The first way, of course, has a capital W. And we don't have to go into that anymore. Although this is talking about an enlightened person. This, of course, would refer to anybody. However, certainly if it's an enlightened person, one would not engage in trivialities in talking to such a person. People engage in so many trivialities. Many, many years ago, we knew a professor who was considered to be quite an eccentric. At the time, we were very young, he was very old. And he used to go around. He had, at that time, there were many trolley cars, and he would be riding in a trolley car. And he, of course, people wore vests. Men wore vests in those days. And the person sitting next to him, perhaps a sweet old lady by way of trying to be nice, and she would say, perhaps, "Good morning, Professor so-and-so. Isn't it a lovely day today?" Without a word, he would take out of a certain pocket of his vest a little card and hand it to the woman. And this card would have something like, "Now, isn't that an original remark?" He used to do that with all manner of people. Of course, the wonder of it is that he lived as long as he did. There's no doubt a lot of people became offended by that, but a lot of people also made to think. This brings up the question, what is an original remark? You know, you take a piece of music. You can hear the same piece of music, have heard it over and over again until it becomes just time-worn. It's what is called an old, what's the word? An old war horse, yes. And then suddenly, a fine conductor plays that same piece that you've heard hundreds of times, and suddenly it's a completely new piece. You find yourself, whereas before, if you'd heard if a second-rate conductor played it, you'd just be bored to tears, say, "Oh, this again," or Beethoven's Fifth again, or whatever the piece happened to be there. But now the piece is just alive. It's a new piece suddenly. Why? Because he's infused a new energy into this thing. And by infusing it with a new energy, he's made really a new thing of it. And it, because it is a fresh and alive and vivid, it has a great power to stimulate us. It takes us beyond our mundane, dualistic mind. Do you begin to get a clue to what is involved here? So we might say it isn't so much what we say, but how we say it. Whether all of us is in it, or whether just our mouth is in it. And the same thing may be said about silence. You know, we speak of a pregnant silence. Also, there used to be a phrase, a fluent silence. There's nobody really that's immune to the implied flattery of a fluent silence. When somebody's talking to you and telling you all about themselves, and you're listening rapt as though for the first time you've heard it. Maybe it's your spouse or something like that, or one of your jokes, your old jokes. This is the real test of a loving husband or wife or student when they can hear the teacher's joke that he's told dozens of times, story, and yet not say, oh boy, here he goes again with that. Of course, whether they say that or not depends upon how it's said. So that silences can also be creative. When somebody is telling something, some harrowing story, even though you've heard it many times before, and if it's really got energy behind it, you're reliving that whole story with the other person. And this brings up a related subject of having sound words. The English language, our American English language, anyway, is badly lacking in these sound words. Well, one could make the appropriate sounds. Appropriate here, of course, means what we're talking about. These live responses when somebody's talking. You get this in Japanese. It's really beautiful. All kinds of intonations and grunts and squeaks. So many sound words, which go along with the conversation. You just don't, as in our culture, you know, somebody is talking, people just look at you. They're just staring, as it were, at you. Sometimes in a kind of a dull, uncomprehending way. Or sometimes if it isn't dull, well, you have the feeling that what they're doing is just trying to see their own reflection in your eyes, so to say. But to be able to be with the person in a total kind of way. To laugh when they laugh, to make these grunts and squeaks that is at the right kind of time there, you know. Oh, so this guy. You get all this kind of stuff, you go up and down the scales, you know, you go sideways and every other way. And yet, oddly enough, if you're talking to a very old friend, there would be these long silences. It seems to be to contradict the other half of it. The older the friend, the better you know, the more intimate, the longer the silences. But these are pregnant, these fluent silences. There's one Japanese professor I was with one time when I asked him about this kind of thing, and his explanation was, the older the friend, the longer the silence. This is to give a chance for the hearts to entwine around each other. Beautifully, a little sentimental, but beautifully put, really. And so we see that there's a silence with a capital S, and with a small s. There's a speaking with a capital S and with a small s. Of course, to Zen students, probably the most familiar, the most vivid expression of silence is Vimalakirti's. You know that famous incident there, all the bodhisattvas, thousands of bodhisattvas gather in this 10-foot room of Vimalakirti. And Manjushri, well, they all go through, you know, they all beg off. In the first place, the Buddha, you know, he pretends to be sick, Vimalakirti, in order to have this mundo with them, and the Buddha tries to get all of his big bodhisattvas to go and And suddenly he discovers they're not as big as he thought they were. They all beg off for one reason or another. And they tell of these remarkable doings around town of Vimalakirti. He seems to be everywhere. Well, finally, some of the big boys, Manjushri and... they're induced to go. And then there begins this mundo. Vimalakirti asks Manjushri, how does a bodhisattva attain the dharma of non-duality? Manjushri says, according to my view, the dharma of non-duality is of no word, no speaking, no presentation, no realization, and is separate from all sorts of mundo. A bodhisattva attains this dharma of non-duality. And then after he's answered, he presses Vimalakirti for his response to the question. We've all stated our views, says Manjushri, who's the leader of the bodhisattvas. What is your answer? And Vimalakirti remains silent. No doubt many of you have seen this paintings of what is called Vimalakirti's thundering silence. And then Manjushri, how wonderful, how can there ever be words and letters? He truly has attained the dharma of non-duality. He's still talking. He's still... He says it's a no word, no speaking, no presentation, no realization. And then he's already talking, and he's already getting out of exactly what he's saying. We see here the big difference between Zen Buddhism and Indian styles of Buddhism, yes. We see the great genius of the Chinese mind. When these were made into Dharma dialogue. And this is why Vimalakirti Sutra is highly esteemed in Zen, even though it has quite a lot of talk. Of course, all of them do. But it is this Vimalakirti's, which is the crux of this sutra, this thundering silence. This is very much admired in Zen. And of course, even to comment, as Manjushri does, on Vimalakirti's silence. The silence is already spoiled. There is here a Zen master's comment on this case. It's quoted by Shibayama Roshi, where the monk says, of course, it is said that if one meets a man of Tao or a man of the way on the way, one must not greet him with words or with silence. I wonder how one should greet him. This, by the way, is a very old saying. It didn't originate with Goso. And the master's reply was, I have seen through the 3,000 worlds. That's the whole universe. Another time when Zen master was asked that same question, he replied, have a cup of tea. Have a cup of tea. In what way have these responses circumvented the trap of this koan? And of course, every koan is setting a trap, a verbal trap. It is trying to deliberately, with malice aforethought, to suck us into reasoning, to verbalizing, to getting into abstractions. The better that we may see the great folly of that, and see how unreal it is, and how it avoids reality. This is the great virtue of Zen. It is seen, and is systematically, you might say, seen. The double edge of words. Now notice, he says, have a cup of tea, please. Those are words. How would you think that these words were uttered? How would you utter them? Although it would be hoped that you'd have something a little more original than that. And I don't mean a little more original, but something that was original and not repeating the same thing. This is what the koans also demand of us. They give us certain clues, certain answers, and then we have to, from those, we have to create our own. Not only words, but our own actions. It's not a question of the words suiting the actions, but that the actions must be suitable. And then the words, if they're needed, they come the right way. They come hot, right out of the guts, the hara, instead of cold, out of the brain. Now we come to Mumon's commentary. If you can give an apt answer to the question, it certainly is a matter for congratulation. If you are not able to give one, be alert in every aspect of your life. Well, now this last one about be alert in every aspect of your life may seem like a fairly obvious kind of thing. Certainly Zen students need to be alert and aware at all times. But the kind of alertness that is required. Some of you may have seen this Japanese film, Seven Samurai, or remember where the swordsman tests his disciples by suddenly walking through a doorway and suddenly attacking them from above the side, one from the side, one from above. And he knows when they're ready, when they're aware and they're alert. And you can only be aware and alert. There's nothing in your mind. And being aware and alert also means observing what needs to be observed, doing what needs to be done, turning off a light when it needs to be turned off, opening a door when it needs to be opened, and closing it when it needs to be closed, not leaving your shoes thrown around in a place where they're kept so that other people have a hard time putting their shoes down. Means not being habitually forgetful. The person who's habitually forgetful is a person whose mind is filled with all kinds of irrelevant thoughts that are just filing, marching through the mind constantly. And of course, the average person isn't even aware of this sort of thing. Of course, there are many degrees of awareness. The highest degree of awareness is a kind of awareness that comes out of enlightenment. Awareness of the indivisibility of all life, all existence. Of course, being aware also means being aware of your practice at all times. If you're working on a koan mu, be aware that this is your practice and not to let your mind get involved with mundane things. This constant inquiring. What is mu? What can it be? What is mu in this situation? What is mu in that situation? If mu is just mu, why don't I know what mu is? Can there be anything outside of mu? If the world were destroyed, would mu be destroyed? This kind of persistent, nagging questioning must go on at all times for the serious person who really wants to get through mu. Isn't enough just in the sesshin? Here we might see many people that come to sesshins. They've done very little really work on their koan. They've got involved in so many other activities. Somehow the koan has got away. Not that the koan has to. One can carry on one's daily life, and always in the back of the mind there is the koan, if it's strong enough. People in Doksan sometimes ask, can you carry on? Usually they're relative beginners. Can you carry on the daily affairs of your life and still carry on the questioning on the koan? The answer is, of course. In fact, this is what you need to do. And many, many lay people who have been very much engaged in the affairs of life have come to deep enlightenment. All through the history of Zen we find that. We still find it in our present time too. But it does require a certain discipline. And this discipline means essentially scruffing off the non-essentials. What's the name of this American who lived in Walden? Thoreau, as Thoreau says. Simplify, simplify, simplify. Talking about his, about one's life. You can't carry on Zen training if you've got a complex, involved life. If you're getting into all kinds of trips, then unless you are a genius of one kind or another, you're going to find it virtually impossible. Apart from Zen training or any other kind of training. Complex life means a life that's full of all kinds of anxieties. And here we're not talking about getting involved in projects which are somehow part of one's way of functioning. There are lots of things that we need to do. But it means gratuitous, unnecessary kind of things. Then we have the verse. If you meet a man of the way on the way, greet him neither with words nor with silence. Here we have the repetition of that. Then those next two lines are very controversial. There are various translations. The one that was read before was the one by Blythe. Shibayama has, I'll give him with my fist the hardest blow I can. Get it at once. Get it immediately. And there is Hakuin's famous comment on that, those last two lines, where he says, I don't like those last two lines at all. I think Mumon made a great mistake with them. When we were working on this koan, Staniroshi said that that translation of give him an uppercut or hit him with your fist, the hardest blow, he feels that that's not a really proper translation. It's rather free. It's the expression there is a very difficult one, evidently, to get an English equivalent. And so it has been given this kind of thing. It doesn't matter, in one sense, really what the translation is, although, of course, it certainly give us the better the translation, the better guide we have, but we have to always try to get to the spirit behind the thing. Of course, if somebody like Hakuin, a great master like Hakuin, says those lines are a mistake, we can certainly question them. But the way I take them, what I take them to mean is, don't wobble. Be direct. Go right to the point. Don't be sentimental. In all of your relationships with people, sentimental here means the wrong, means sentimentality, the not honest sentiment. Of course, this is a fine thing. We're talking about sentimentality, a kind of a wishy-washiness. People respond to directness and sureness. As for understanding, you'll understand it once. When there is this directness, there is no gaps. At that moment, there's no thought of self or other. There's no reasoning. There's no theorizing. What goes from the mind goes to the mind, or as the saying has it, what goes from the, comes from the heart goes to the heart. Directly, without any intervention. In other words, speak also clearly. Speak purely. Purely means clearly, without equivocation. You know, Confucius says, if you know, say you know. If you don't know, say you don't know. Very simple, direct statement. How many people can do this? The people are ashamed if they ask a question. They feel somehow they should know the answer if they don't know the answer. They can't say, I don't know. And contrariwise, there are some people who are inordinately modest. That you won't find people, Zen people, where their Zen is freely working. They know where they stand, and they don't hesitate to express themselves. This doesn't mean that one has to be rude or crude. As we see in the Chinese mode of expression, this wonderful indirectness which gives you lots of room for maneuver. And of course this kind of praising by condemning and the speaking out of the side of the mouth, this doesn't fall under the same category of what's being said right now. That other adds, that Chinese way adds a real richness. But there's this other kind of, and of course it also means not in your conversation, in your relations with other people, don't obtrude yourself. There's no need when somebody's saying something, telling you something, there's no need to tell them about yourself. Unless, of course, that person can help you and you get some kind of a problem. Just to make the comment, well, yes, now I did so-and-so, too. I did the same kind of thing, and I said the same kind of thing, and I think so-and-so. It's the kind of thing that just builds up our egos. You listen, just listen. And if you're speaking, just speak. This is really giving the hardest blow you can. And this is really a blow for freedom. Because the other kind of speaking and acting, relating, there's always some kind of a carryover, some kind of an attachment. Even to be wishy-washy is an attachment. It's an attachment to a certain uncertainty that one feels in one's mind. Because lots of times people can't help that because they are so off-center all the time. They have no center at all, and so they're subject to every wind that comes along, ill wind or any other kind of wind. Next time you're on the way and you meet somebody on the way, in the way or out of the way, but on the way, don't give them an uppercut physically, but let them understand that you understand, that you both understand. You understand what? You understand everything and you understand nothing. Now let us say something about the Sesshin. Yesterday in one of the encouragement talks, remark was made about the session, it started off with a bang. It was almost going to end in a whimper. But that has all changed. Usually sessions come together a little quicker than this one does, did. But this one has come together. And it has come together because enough people finally responded, not to the encouragement talks, but to their own selves, their own Buddha nature, if we may use a dirty word. This is not trying to shine the apple, as they say. This is a fact. Monitors have felt it, and so have I. The significance of this, in terms of the rest of the session, is that because the session has come together, the energies of the session have coalesced, have focused. It is possible for, in these last hours, some 5 or 6 hours that remain for the session, for people to get through the koan yet. There are enough people who don't have far to go, as one step, so as to make this a reality. You've heard during the session one or two stories of people who literally made come true what they wanted to come true, namely to see through the koan. Again, as you've heard, this kind of capacity is difficult. To bring about this kind of thing at the beginning or the middle of a session is very hard. The story that you heard about the monk, the head monk, who before the session said he was going to have another enlightenment, he was a very seasoned man. He'd been practicing for probably 35 years. And he'd had one or two enlightenments already before this time. You could say that his practice was a matured practice. Nevertheless, at this stage of a session, where there is so much jodiki, and again, as you've heard again and again, where it is not dissipated, but it is all telescoped into these last hours. As the hours get less and less, this means each hour it's more and more jodiki in it, so to say. This is really a fact. So that if you continue to absorb yourselves, to continue the questioning, you can still get through, those of you who haven't. And the last doksan, as you know, this is usually reserved for people who feel that they've are able to answer questions about their koan, and people who are working on subsequent koans. And this is a custom. Other people, there will be no opportunity for any more sessions. Stop here and recite the formula.